It's time for the all-new Gervie's Law, cross-examining the ages, with your host, Alan Gervie, and introducing your co-host, Michelle Lobato. Alan is the managing partner of the law firm of Rowan, Gervie & Wynn, a workers' compensation law firm which has represented injured workers for over 40 years. And now, here's your host, Alan Gervie.
Hi, I am Alan Gervie, and this is Gervie's Law, and I'm here with Michelle Lobato. Welcome back, Michelle.
Hi, everyone. I'm so glad to be here.
You are, aren't you?
Yes.
You look very nice.
Thank you.
And I know you're a big fan of the Supreme Court.
I am, yes.
Who's your favorite?
RBG.
RBGs. I'm talking about now, the Supreme Court now. It's like you have a favorite player. I'm a big Minnesota Vikings fan. Unfortunately, not this year because I am a fan, but they're doing terrible. But if you ask me, Justin Jefferson would be my favorite player on the Vikings. What about you? Do you want to talk about that or do you have a favorite?
You know, I think we have a better person to point to on that.
Oh,
yeah.
She is not going to take the bait. I want to welcome to the show Ilya Soman. He, of course, is a constitutional law expert who's been on our show before. And I love talking to Ilya because he tells it like it is. He's a professor of law at George Mason University, and he's been quoted everywhere. He's written for the Yale Law Journal, Stanford Law Review, Georgetown Law Journal, published articles in New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, been on CNN and quoted widely through all the media, both terrestrial and social media. And he's here today on Gervie's Law to talk about the Supreme Court cases on the docket. It's our annual salute to the Supreme Court. I don't know if you can salute them, but we can review them. Ilya, welcome back to Gervie's Law.
Thank you very much for having me.
I'm glad to have you. What's been going on? Before we talk about some of these cases, what's been going on with you? And you haven't been on the show for a while, so tell us a little bit about what you've been up to.
Well, the life of a law professor isn't all that exciting. I write a lot of articles and books and things of that sort. So, for instance, right now I'm working on an article on why illegal migration and drug smuggling do not qualify as invasion under the Constitution or under the Alien Enemies Act, an issue that may well return to the Supreme Court sooner rather than later. And I'm also working on a variety of other academic and intellectual projects on issues of immigration, federalism, and also property rights and organ markets. I have an article coming out about that. As you likely know, I'm also co-counsel for the plaintiffs in one of the tariff cases that is currently before the Supreme Court. So that was sort of an unusual venture for me. Though I should note, I was not the person who argued the case when an oral argument happened about a month ago.
It's funny because we've had Aaron Chemerinsky on the show quite a bit as well, and he finds himself sometimes in the fray when you have a case. And do they approach you? I mean, the tariffs is such an important issue, obviously, in the media all day, every day, as well as the immigration, which, you know, of course, I think your writings on that are going to be something really important people want to read. But tell us how you get involved in a case where you're principally, and I hope you don't take offense to it, an academic, one of the elite academics. But how do you get involved in the Supreme Court case?
Well, it's very unusual for me. This is the first time I've been involved in a case like that as one of the lawyers, as opposed to as just writing an amicus brief or something like that. Basically, what happened is, as has already been recounted in the media, I wrote a blog post back in February arguing that people should challenge the new Trump IEPA tariffs based on the non-delegation and major questions doctrine. I was contacted by Jeff Schwab, who is the senior counsel for the Liberty Justice Center, a public interest law firm. He said, you know, we're interested in potentially bringing this case, and one thing led to another. I helped them recruit potential clients for the case, and then they also invited me to be one of the lawyers on it. So here we are.
And just before we get to the other cases we want to talk about with the Supreme Court, tell us what the status is right now and whether you might argue in front of the justices of the Supreme Court.
So it is extremely unlikely that I will be doing any arguments in front of the justices before the Supreme Court, because the status of the case is that it was argued last month. And it was argued on our behalf by Neil Katyal of Georgetown Law School and former acting Solicitor General of the U.S. He certainly did a much better job, most likely, than I would have done had I had to do the oral argument. Our case is now combined with a case brought by 12 states challenging the tariffs, and also with the Learning Resources case, a case brought by toy makers. All three cases are together before the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court will likely issue a decision sometime in the coming months.
And there will be no further oral argument with the three cases?
None that I know of.
Well, then I'm sure everyone will be looking forward to what the decision is. Any predictions?
So predictions are difficult to make, particularly about the future. As Yogi Berra said, all I can say is I think we have some strong arguments that can appeal to justices across the political and jurisprudential spectrum.
I appreciate you referring to the legal expert, Yogi Berra.
That's awesome. Ilya, on a more personal matter, I'm just curious. It sounds like you're... there's this term that us young people use called, quote unquote, locking in. It sounds like, you know, the Constitution itself seems so, big? And I just want to know, what is your routine and how you lock in and like really go line by line and work?
So I obviously don't work on every issue in the Constitution. I think few, if any, academics do. There's too many of them. So I have a set of issues that I write about routinely, particularly issues related to federalism, property rights, and certain questions related to separation.
But how many hours, how many espresso shots, what time of day is this? I'm very curious.
Not many espresso shots because I'm one of the few legal scholars who don't drink coffee. As for hours...
I don't drink coffee either, and I'm not even a scholar.
Okay, well, there are probably more non-scholars who don't drink than scholars, but who knows?
Thank you.
So I think the number of hours really varies a lot, you know, from week to week. Some weeks it's a lot, some weeks it's fewer. Obviously, I have other responsibilities, including teaching and grading and committee meetings and so forth, and those also take up varying amounts of time from week to week.
Wow, that's impressive. I mean, the no espresso shots and being able to handle all of this work on top of your teaching job is really commendable.
Okay, enough kissing up. Let's let's get to the brass tacks here. Tell us, we're going to talk about three or four cases. Tell us what they are, what your favorite cases that you're looking forward to. And then, of course, our legal here, Michelle, has done all the research, so she'll be able to cross-examine you on those cases.
Sure. So you want me to list the three or four cases, or you're going to do so?
Well, we can start with Trump versus Slaughter. Is that the one
really
we want
like
to start
with? I really like that name. Yeah, sure. Slaughter. So it is my understanding.
My God. Did you really just say that?
I do like. I think I like when Supreme Court cases have the funny word. You know, the play on words. So it is my...
I don't think Rebecca Slaughter will think that way, that it's just her name.
I apologize to Rebecca Slaughter for that.
Her name.
But it works.
The issue is really important.
Because she's getting slaughtered from the FTC.
Okay. Ilya, what do you have to say to bring a little more of an intellectual perspective on this difficult case? Because I think it could go either way.
Sure. So I'm less expert on this case than some of the others we're going to discuss, but I do teach intro constitutional law, and this issue comes up there. This case is about the president's removal power. And the question is, can Congress create executive branch offices, at least in some cases, where the president doesn't have an unlimited power to fire the top people in that particular agency, in this case, the Federal Trade Commission. Rebecca Slaughter, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but as I understand it, she is one of the commissioners. And according to the statute that was adopted by Congress, the president can only fire her for narrowly specified reasons. But the administration and so-called unitary executive theorists argue that limitations on the president's power to remove high-ranking executive branch officials violate the Constitution because this is an inherent part of the executive power.
Do you think it makes a difference, though, what agency, which federal agency the employee is working for?
I think it probably does, though exactly what difference it makes is highly contestable. But in the 1935 case of Humphrey's executor, which the Supreme Court may reverse or severely limit in the Swatter case, the court said that Congress can impose limitations on the removal power in situations where the agency is not a purely executive agency, but also has what they called quasi-legislative and quasi-judicial powers. This was actually in a case involving the FTC, also, though the FTC has changed somewhat since the 1930s. And so one of the things the court will need to decide here is that limitation about quasi-legislative or quasi-judicial agencies still in force? And if so, what does it mean for an agency to be quasi-legislative or quasi-judicial? You know, these things are, you know, not entirely clear. In the case of Trump versus Wilcox, which is a shadow docket case decided earlier this year, the Supreme Court strongly intimated that the majority does want to overrule Humphrey's executor, or at least limited. But they also said at the same time, that doesn't mean the president has the power to remove whenever he wants to members of the Federal Reserve Board, because the Federal Reserve Board is different from other agencies. They were not at all clear about what exactly makes the Federal Reserve differently, but there's different. But there's another case on the docket called Trump v. Cook, which is about the president's efforts to try to fire a member of the Federal Reserve Board, and there the court may indeed try to explain what makes the Federal Reserve different. So I think the bottom line is what kind of agency it is likely does make a difference. But exactly what kind of difference it makes, well, you know, the court may tell us in one or both of these cases, Trump v. Cook and also Trump v. Swatter.
Considering a philosophical perspective for a second, because I think you're talking practical, do you think judicial activism versus judicial restraint plays a role when you talk about the Humphreys case? You know, you can probably find any kind of changes to a governmental agency such as the Federal Trade Commission. But does the makeup of the court, of the Supreme Court, and their philosophical perspective on a strict reading or strict adherence to a previous case have any place here in this discussion, which would be activism if you're not going to follow Humphreys, or restraint if you are?
So I would say two things. One is activism and restraint are themselves fairly vague and contestable concepts, and what counts as activism is often in the eyes of the beholder. You could argue that overturning a longstanding precedent or even severely limiting it is a kind of activism. On the other hand, you know, many people who would not be happy if the court were to overrule Humphrey's executor are very happy about lots of other previous decisions of reversing, you know, longstanding precedents. Certainly in the 1930s and 40s, the Supreme Court reversed a lot of longstanding precedents on federalism, on economic liberties, and other issues which most political liberals are happy about today. Obviously, in the 50s, with Brown versus Board, they, if not reversed, then at least severely limited Plessy versus Ferguson. So almost everybody agrees that there are cases where it's justifiable to reverse longstanding precedent. The question is when and what the criteria for that should be.
But isn't it also a question of whether you would defer to the legislature for statutory change versus taking the proactive step of overruling a precedent?
So there is a separate set of issues of whether courts should give deference to the legislature. Again, here too, most people would agree that there are situations where the courts should not be deferential because part of the purpose of the Constitution is to limit legislative power, and also, of course, that of the executive as well. So to my mind, while there are some principled people who say the court should always defer or rarely, if ever, defer, arguments about deference to a large extent come down to like whether you think who is correct about the underlying dispute. If you think that unitary executive theory is correct, then it is highly likely that you also argue that we shouldn't defer to the legislature here. If you think that unitary executive theory is wrong, or at least has significant flaws, then you will tend to conclude that, you know, Humphrey's executors should not be overruled, or at least should not be greatly modified. But I think attitudes towards that will strongly correlate with what you think of the underlying merits of the issue at hand, and the same tends to be true for most major constitutional issues.
Ilya, touching on the Cook case, so you believe that Lisa Cook had, that was a misunderstanding with the whole mortgage fraud accusation.
So let me put on my hat as a property professor, which I also am. It does not seem to me that she committed mortgage fraud. I'm not certain about this, but such evidence as I have seen suggest that she did not mislead the lender in such a way as would make it likely that they give her much more lenient or any seemingly more lenient mortgage terms than she would get otherwise. But obviously the broad issue in this case is not really whether she committed mortgage fraud, although that's part of it, but mm-hmm. what should be the scope of the president's power, if
for
any,
cause.
To remove members of the Federal Reserve Board. And if he can only remove them for cause, then the question arises, well, what is sufficient cause?
You don't think that this
the
is...
The president here is arguing that for cause is whatever he says it is. And I think the Supreme Court will not accept that argument, because that if for cause just means whatever the president thinks is a sufficient cause, then it's no real limitation at all. The Federal Reserve completely under the thumb of the president, which would be very bad, both in practical terms, but I think also in constitutional separation of powers terms as well.
That's why I don't understand this case, because to me it seems more like political weaponization versus a simple employment law case of factual versus law. I mean, when we practice law and we're not at the appellate court, we talk about the facts. And if it is an employment law regarding a case, regarding the facts, the trier of fact should be able to handle this without getting into the political ramifications, such as in this case.
So you are far more an expert in employment law than I am, so I'm going to have to defer to you. I've written a whole book about political ignorance, have to respect the limits of my own knowledge. So I would just make this limited statement about this, and you feel free to correct me based on your superior knowledge of employment law. One issue is that employment in a high-ranking government agency may not be the same thing as sort of employment in the private sector, or even being a more humble public employee like me, where, you know, I'm a professor at a state law school, but my job isn't nearly as important and powerful as a member of the Federal Reserve Board. So,
but your writings are, Ilya.
Yeah. So that's nice of you to say, but my writings still very likely have far less impact on the world than the Federal Reserve's control of the world's dominant currency.
Maybe so.
The second issue is, and here, even if the president's real motive is not the ostensible cause that is stated, but just that he would like to put somebody on the board that's more amenable to his interest than Ms. Cook is, still, it may be he has the right to fire her so long as a proper cause does exist, even if that proper cause is not his true motive. Now, in employment law, sometimes there's anti-discrimination rules which say you cannot fire this person, say, based on their race,
right,
or sex or ethnicity or the like, even if you have an alternative reason that's plausible. Here, maybe you could try to make an argument like that, but it doesn't seem like having political or policy motives is inherently improper in a way that race or sex discrimination, for instance, would be, and that maybe if the president has sufficient cause to fire her, it's arguable that he can still do that, even if that cause is not actually his real motive.
You know, you could be an employment lawyer because those are all issues that are relevant and germane. And I think that's what we may hear about in arguments in this case. In our last few minutes, you pick a couple cases that you want to talk about, and we'll go with that.
Sure. So I would note a couple cases related to immigration. One is definitely before the court. Another that so far is not, but there's a good chance that it will be. One is the birthright citizenship case, which the court granted cert on, I believe, on Friday.
Yeah.
And obviously, this is going to be a hugely important case in that hundreds of thousands of children children born this year or in the future may be denied birthright citizenship if Trump were to win this case. I'm guardedly optimistic that he will lose it because I think the evidence, both originalist and otherwise, is strongly against his position, but I'm not categorically certain about what will happen.
Do you think the political makeup of the court will have any effect?
So we will see. Ideally, it should. However, it is the case that, there's some tendency of Supreme Court justices like the rest of us, that if they like the result, they also will tend to feel like it's more likely to be constitutional. I don't think it's true to say that the Supreme Court justices, any of them, are just purely political and just vote for results they like. But at the margin, that kind of thing, I think, can make a difference because, they're human beings who have trouble completely setting aside biases, just like you and I do. So it could be that with at least a couple justices who are, very conservative and therefore also may be sympathetic to immigration restrictions, that may affect their thinking on this. Obviously, with certain liberal justices, it could go the other way. But I also think, the arguments on this are much stronger for one side than the other, and that will weigh on the justices, which is why I'm guardedly optimistic that the court is not going to rule in favor of administration in this case, though obviously we won't know for sure for some months yet.
Okay, what about the other? You said there were two cases or a couple of cases.
The other is a case, an issue that I think may well return the court, but I do not know for certain. That is the issue of the Alien Enemies Act, where Trump has been trying to use this law from 1798, which says that it only can be used in the event of a declared war, an invasion, or, quote, a predatory incursion. He's been trying to use it to deport Venezuelan migrants with little or no due process. And lower courts have, for the most part, ruled that he cannot do this because illegal migration, drug smuggling, and other similar activities do not count as an invasion or even as a predatory incursion, but there has been some disagreement in the lower courts. The Supreme Court, in a couple of shadow docket decisions earlier this year, did not actually rule on the ultimate merits of this, but they did impose or uphold lower court injunctions preventing Trump from deporting people under this and holding also that courts do have the power to interpret the meaning of terms in the Alien Enemies Act. And so I think there is a good chance that this issue will return to Supreme Court. If so, it has implications beyond the Alien Enemies Act specifically because the term invasion also occurs multiple times in the Constitution. And it is very unlikely that it means something different in the Alien Enemies Act enacted in 1798 than in the Constitution enacted just a few years earlier. So if illegal migration and drug smuggling qualify as an invasion, that has drastic implications in the Constitution. One is the federal government would be able to suspend a writ of habeas corpus pretty much any time they want, because we pretty much always have illegal migration and drug smuggling across some borders. Also, the Constitution states that, quote, when a state is, quote, actually invaded, it can engage in war in response. And so a state into which illegal migration or drug smuggling is occurring would then thereby be empowered to engage in war pretty much at any time. So Texas or Arizona or California, if they wanted to, could start a war with Mexico whenever they felt like as a result of this.
I think you've made a good argument for this.
So I have an entire article devoted to this issue, plus together with the Cato Institute, the Brennan Center, and others, I have filed amicus briefs in a couple of the Alien Enemies Act cases outlining the argument that illegal migration and drug smuggling do not, in fact, qualify. Yeah.
I think it's compelling. We only have a minute left, but it's, you know, interesting listening to you. And I'm just thinking the Supreme Court probably would not have anything to do. They would not have jobs if it wasn't for Trump, because every case seems to have that overtone, which is unfortunate in a lot of ways, because there are other cases that deserve the Supreme Court's attention. Ilya Soman, I want to thank you for, again, being an expert here on Gervais Law on these cases, and we look forward to catching up with you next time to find out what the outcome has been with the cases you've talked about. Thanks for being with us today.
Thanks, Ilya.
Thank you very much for having me.
All right, take care, and that's going to do it for another Gervais Law episode. We will see you next time. Thanks for listening.